Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. This is Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. All right, our friend Renee Dobos is back. She's president and CEO of Connecticut Housing Partners. You've heard about them here on the program. They are creating systematic change and sustainable solutions for individuals and families that strengthen our communities. They measurably transform lives and communities by providing a sustainable solution to end the Connecticut housing crisis. If you've listened to this show in the past 5 years, three times, you've heard about the housing crisis two or three times. We've got a situation here in Connecticut, and Connecticut Housing Partners are working overtime to fix it. We will chat with Renee about that and some exciting news that she brings us back from our nation's capital right after we remind you. You've heard them on For the People, and we're thrilled to have our community partners at the Connecticut Age Well Collaborative talking and taking it to the street. The collaborative just announced its next big endeavor, Age Well Fest 2024. It's coming to the Meriden Green on September 12th. Age Well Fest is a first of its kind in-person experiential learning opportunity for every Connecticut community for the Vibe Think First Night, but in the daytime, and that meets conference, but without slide decks. Who should attend? Well, municipal leaders, community stakeholders, policymakers. Renee, maybe you want to go. Anyone and everyone interested in fostering more aging, dementia, and disability inclusive communities should be there. So save the date and get familiar with the schedule of activities as they develop by visiting ctagewellcollaborative.org, AgeWellFest. I'm pleased to be part of that network. And Renee, maybe you and your folks can develop some new contacts and friendships there. But in the meantime, you've been making more friends in Washington, D.C. let's go to the big news. You're getting a piece of almost $76 million in grant funding from NeighborWorks. Let's first talk about that.
Sure. NeighborWorks, we're a chartered member of NeighborWorks, and there's only 249 of us throughout the United States and Puerto Rico. And so this is a very prestigious relationship to have. It's almost like the good housekeeping seal of approval for affordable housing developers such as ourselves. And so in March, I went with a contingent of other NeighborWorks folks where we went to the Hill and lobbied for NeighborWorks because NeighborWorks receives their funding through Congress. So we go down there to talk about the impact that we're having, how important NeighborWorks is to the nation, and that with all of us combined, we're the largest and most impactful affordable housing developers in the nation. So $2 million of that appropriations will be coming to the state of Connecticut. So what does that mean? What that means is that we can take that $2 million, our seven organizations, and we can parlay that money. And we're able to leverage that investment. And last year, we turned that $2 million into a $97 million investment in the state of Connecticut by creating new homes, by repairing homes, preserving homes, creating more rental homes, counseling services, and plus we created over 500 jobs with this investment.
Fantastic.
So it's really important.
Let me just stop you there. It's early Sunday morning. Mm-hmm. People are listening to the radio and making breakfast or getting ready for church or whatever. You just said a mouthful there that we need to spend just a couple minutes on. Because I think a lot of people, when they think about housing and creating housing opportunities in Connecticut and in your neck of the woods, they're thinking about knocking down an entire city block and putting 200-300 apartments up, but the fact that you guys are rehabbing existing housing stock and helping expand existing opportunities, I think it is lost on a lot of people when you talk about creating more and better housing for our residents.
Well, it's really true, and you know, because we also don't want neighborhoods to go into disrepair either. But more importantly, in the state of Connecticut, we're really facing a crisis where we have a shortage of 92,500 units. And then when I'm talking about affordable, I'm really talking about the workforce, because affordable is not the low-income people that are being impacted. It's about our entire workforce, our police, our firefighters, our nurses, our teachers, bus drivers, grocery workers. These are all the people that are in our communities serving us, but yet they can't live in the community where they're serving us because it's unaffordable to them. So it's really impacting our workforce. And so you say, okay, well, so what? So they can't live in that community. What does that mean? Well, what it means is that your businesses in your community are unable to grow because they can't attract the workforce that they need. So it's a trickle-down effect of how it impacts our entire economy. Yeah. Our governor is trying to recruit new business into the state all of the time. The first question he's being asked is, where are the workers going to live? He's getting feedback from businesses saying, I'm ready to grow, I'm ready to expand, but I can't get the workforce that I need to help me grow because there's no place for them to live. So this is really an economic crisis and could really impact the health of our state, because if you're a worker and you can't afford to live where you're working, you're going to find a place to live where you can afford, and that may not be the state of Connecticut. So we can end up losing some of our population because of that.
Right. And I had somebody point out to me the other day, taking that concept even one step further. So say somebody who works in Middletown has to live, out toward, Eastern Connecticut, out in the Marlboro area or East Hampton or what have you, or they work in Bridgeport, but they have to live up in someplace like Thomaston or Torrington because that's where they can afford to live. Every time that individual makes that ride to their workplace, 20, 30, 40 miles away, they're passing other job opportunities that may be more attractive to them, maybe not because it pays more, but just because it gives them this precious gift of time that they're otherwise spending in their commute. So every time we're reeling in a workforce member from beyond our own community, every day that employer is at risk of losing that worker because they may, in all likelihood, want to reduce their travel time. And there's plenty of jobs that at equal parity in compensation. So it really is. You're getting this multiple hit of risk here when you don't have enough housing in your own community to support your own people and your own business.
That is absolutely true. And if you even care about the climate, just think of the carbon emissions that are going on with those long commutes back and forth, the wear and tear on our roads. So there's so many different layers to this that are being impacted. Sure. And you're absolutely right. You know, quality of life is so important to everybody.
Yeah, work-life balance does not factor in a 2 to 3 hour commute every day when there's an alternative, even maybe for a little bit less pay.
So, sorry, we
kind of veered off here just a little bit. So, but the other important thing that you mentioned in your introduction was that we're not just creating workforce housing, we're creating jobs for the workforce by developing these or rehabbing this housing.
That is correct. Yes. Because we're very reliant on the construction industry, engineers, architects, environmental studies that have to take place. So So there's many different people that we have to interface with to be able to rehab or build new construction. You know, we're interfacing with planning and zoning departments in different communities. And so all of these generate jobs and also keep a community vibrant. We're investing in a community. That's how we view our work, that we're investing in a community. We want to work closely with the leadership of the community. And we really try to educate the community to make them understand how important this housing is. And we're also starting to talk to big business, because we can't just rely on the state of Connecticut to solve this problem. Right now, our shortage of 92,500 units, the pipeline that the state has is 6,500 units in the next 3 years. Mm-hmm. That's just scratching at it. That's just scratching at the surface of the problem. Mm-hmm. So we're starting to talk to the big business, because we need to make them understand they need to help solve this problem as well. They need to be thinking about themselves as a benefactor and not just a boss, right? They need to care where their workforce is. And they need to care about the quality of life that they're providing for their workforce. So in the state of Connecticut, for one person to be considered middle class, they have to earn $80,000 a year. So I ask all big business, how many of your employees are earning less than $80,000 a year? So those are the people that you need to think about. Our medium income in the state of Connecticut is only $69,000 a year. So you could see that income is not keeping pace with the cost to rent, the, you know, inflation, and also the opportunity for young people to buy their first home is becoming out of reach.
Yeah, we're in deficit mode every day. Yeah.
Every day. And so that puts more pressure on the product that I'm delivering, where I'm delivering workforce housing. So it's putting more pressure, and the demand is growing and growing, and I can barely build fast enough myself. So that's why we need big business to get engaged in this, because if they do, when they're complaining about, I'm ready to expand, and where is my workforce going to live, they need to participate in solving that problem.
Yeah. So NeighborWorks America celebrated its 45th anniversary this year. When did you, as a housing advocate and the president and CEO of the Connecticut Housing Partnership here, when did you become familiar with NeighborWorks, and how are you going to, continue moving forward with your nonprofit partners around the state in getting maximum traction for this chunk of the $76 million that you were able to achieve?
Sure. We have actually been members of NeighborWorks since 1994. Next year, we will be celebrating our 35-year anniversary, so we've been doing this work for a very long time. I am in constant contact with my NeighborWorks partners here in the state of Connecticut. We help each other. We talk to each other. We strategize together, and we also have a voice with the Department of Housing and the Connecticut Housing Finance Authority. So we're constantly advocating. So if we're not only just advocating on the Hill in Washington, D.C., but we're talking to our local politicians at the state as well to make sure that they understand what our needs are. And so it's really important to keep having these conversations and making everybody understand the crisis that we're in and what we need. And the state, even though they've made tremendous investment financially into workforce housing, they can't do it all, right? They have limited resources just like everybody else. So we need to figure out a new way and a new method to make this happen.
Well, one of the other things I really like catching up with you about is, looking at the work you've done and the work you're planning to do. Here we are nearing the midpoint in 2024. How is the year so far measuring up against your victories and successes of 2023?
We are doing great. Our pipeline is very strong. We are about to break ground on rehabilitating a 69-unit development in Stamford, Connecticut. A few months after that, we'll be breaking ground on rehabilitating a 44-unit development in Bridgeport. We just received a purchase sale agreement for property in Bridgeport, where we're going to build additional supportive housing within the city of Bridgeport. We have a purchase sale agreement on property in Stratford that we will be building workforce housing there. I also just entered into a partnership with another developer who's from out of state, and we're working together to build property, brand new construction in Plymouth, Connecticut, and then we'll, you know, manage it for them once it's built. So we have, there's so many opportunities. We're working very hard. I have an entire real estate development team where this is all they do all day long. Is, you know, get these projects started, get the applications into the state of Connecticut, because the biggest challenge is I can't just go to one place to get the funding. I have to build the capital stack. We rely very heavily on tax credit infusion, which helps keep debt service down on the property so that we can keep rent down. And that's what's so important about the tax credits. And so it's very complicated because, you know, you're dealing with the state of Connecticut. So you can imagine the application process is very long and hard. And it cost us about $350,000 to get an application to the state for them to begin reviewing it, because we have to get architectural plans in place. We have to do some environmental work. There's just many costs attached to it to get the application in place. But we're always talking to the state. We're always talking to them about our projects, so we know we have a green light before we put the application in, because we're not going to risk that money. We're going to make sure that the state's interested before we begin that investment.
So let's switch gears a little bit and talk about you,
Renee
Dobos, because you weren't just recently recognized by Congressman Jim Himes for your leadership and community impact. You were also, as we may have mentioned prior to it happening, you were recognized as one of the top 10 inspiring women leaders of 2024. Talk about your team and your colleagues across the state who are women leading great teams. And, you know, serving your cohorts, because so many of the people who are seeking workforce housing are women heads of households who are carrying the whole burden.
Yes, they are. I think women are very hardworking, and they always have the family is the center of their universe, and many things that they do are for their family. I do have many colleagues that are women and have been doing this work for a very long time. I look up to them. I was very honored when Jim Himes sent that letter to me. I was very surprised by that. And I think it's because I'm very passionate about this, and I have a very loud voice. So whether you want to hear me or not, you're going to hear me. So. Mm. It's important.
In terms of the Inspiring Women's Leaders Award for 2024, you also, aside from all that you're doing, you take the extra time to, if not mentor in the moment, and have an open door to your colleagues and cohorts on your team, but you're also you and your team members are also mentoring the next generation of Connecticut housing advocates and leaders.
That's correct. Yes, we are. We're really working very hard to leave a legacy. I guess that's the way to put it. Mm. I won't be here forever. And so I have a very strong team built behind me that I am confident would be the successors if for whatever reason I leave this organization. And I'm very proud that we've been able to build that kind of team. And I know that colleagues that I work with, they are also proud to build that team. And I also get excited when I see someone that I've been working with at another organization who may have been at a director level, and then they move to another organization and now they're the CEO. And then, you know, then we get together and then we talk and then, we can help shape that person to make sure that they're successful as well, because we all know each other, right? In this industry, we all know each other and we all help each other.
Renee Dobos, she is the president and CEO of Connecticut Housing Partners, strengthening communities by providing housing and service to enhance the quality of life for all our families. Their developments and programs have produced more than $100 million in community investments, providing safe, secure, affordable housing and workforce housing to more than 1,000 residents. And as you heard, she just headed down to Washington and brought Connecticut back another around $2 million from the NeighborWorks program, continuing their good work. If you'd like to learn more or partner with them, maybe you're an investor, you're a builder, you're a developer, maybe you'd like to be part of the solution, just get to know Connecticut Housing Partners at ConnecticutCTHousingPartners.org, I should say, CTHousingPartners.org. And Renee, thank you so much for your time this morning, and we'll talk to you again soon. Well, as I was just sharing with my guest this morning from Triangle Community Center down Norwalk Way, that this organization has been a tried and true guest on the award-winning For the People, and we're so happy to welcome them back here during Pride Month as we wrap up Pride Week. And also so pleased to meet and introduce their new executive director, Rachel Simon. Julie Walsh is also on the line with us. She's deputy director of the Triangle Community Center. Thank you both for being part of the program this morning. Let's talk a little bit, Rachel, about your journey to the position of leadership there at Triangle. Let's hear a little bit about your background and how the transition into that role has been for you.
Yeah, thanks, John, and thanks for having us on For the People. So my name is Rachel Simon. I use she and they pronouns, and I have been the executive director at Triangle Community Center in Norwalk since early September of last year, of 2023, and I came here from running a university LGBT center in Westchester County, but have been a queer activist since, I don't know, probably the mid-90s in Texas, which is not a place I would recommend to be a queer activist.
I say turn over all the cards because
very needed.
Yeah, we could just spend the rest of the 15 minutes on Texas stories, I'm sure.
Yes. Yeah. But I think through that activism and trainings and kind of leadership mentors that I had, I've had a long career. And now I serve as the Westchester County LGBT Advisory Board's chair. So although I work in Norwalk, I live in Westchester County and am involved on both sides of the New York, Connecticut border in doing good work to advance the LGBT community and our rights.
Well, given that background and your passion, we're both lucky to have you. So appreciate you coming up to Norwalk for the day job and giving us the benefit of all your experience. You have touched on a couple of really important points in your background, including working in a college environment where arguably this is the time and the age where a lot of people make the decision to come out, right?
Well, and I think people often make that decision around their safety. And I know for me, I went to high school in Texas and chose to apply to universities only in New England and ended up in Maine because there was a giant buffer between, especially in the days before the internet, between my Texas high school and my Maine university. So I think a lot of people feel that same freedom and the buffer from what they may have experienced in high school. So I think college is a great time. One of the limitations is, especially for trans folks, is that when you move into your first college residence hall, it doesn't come with a magic gift card, so you can buy all new clothes that are in alignment with your gender identity. So a lot of the work that we did at the university was not just around policies, but around letting people know that someone might not look the way you would expect when they share specific pronouns with you, because unless you're Caitlyn Jenner, you don't have the money necessarily to change your whole wardrobe if you're making a big change. But also, I think this young generation is moving away from the binary. I know at Triangle Community Center, one of our biggest monthly groups is the non-binary group, and introducing identities like non-binary trans folks to the older generation who may be less familiar, and helping them show, especially young people, respect in the education space and in all spaces.
Hmm. I remember last year speaking with your predecessor about this opportunity to bring these generations together, and sometimes the sheer joy that was experienced in seeing the embrace and the acceptance and the inclusion that is experienced in these situations sometimes.
Yeah, we've got young people today who have always, their experience of same gender, same sex marriage has existed legally their whole lives.
Yes, yeah.
And models of queer couples having children has been available to them their whole lives. So for folks, my middle age and older, to connect with younger folks is really powerful. We have at TCC a group for seniors that meets every other Friday called Coffee Talk. So we try to not just, to make sure that people at every stage of life can find queer community here.
That's great. Let's give you a break, Rachel, and meet Julie Walsh, Deputy Director. Julie, you've come to Connecticut even more recently than Rachel, haven't you?
I started here at Triangle Community Center at the beginning of this year. I bring a history of nonprofit organizing and development, having founded and directed a nonprofit for trans and non-binary folks in Indiana for 8 years. I then moved out to the East Coast during the pandemic, and I was able to join these lovely folks to really continue to grow and expand the programming and offerings that are here at Triangle Community Center.
Mm-hmm. So, like Rachel, in Texas, you were also coming from a state where there's a lot of issues and adversity, and I have to say the life's experiences that both of you bring to the table and to the benefit of the community and Triangle here is quite unique and spectacular, because you both kind of had to spend a lot of time in your life facing adversity and folks who may have really deeply rooted fundamental, even spiritual disagreements with your lifestyle. How do you articulate, I'll start with you, Julie, especially when a younger member of the LGBTQ community that you meet, whether it's a Triangle or anywhere, and you're talking to them and they're telling you about how upsetting and anxiety making it is for them when they're essentially getting character assassinated for their sexuality.
It's true. And, coming from more conservative states where we are accustomed to working with folks who have trying experiences, it still translates here, because even in the Northeast, we encounter many communities here where folks are not understood or validated for who they are, whether that is affirming one's gender or affirming one's sexual orientation. And it's really important that we have a space where our community can connect and find one another with support and truly see for themselves that they can be proud and joyful in their authentic identity.
Hmm. Rachel, do you find yourself in situations where you're able to call on experiences that you may have had when you lived in Texas to help coach or counsel or mentor a younger person who may be facing the same thing right here in Fairfield County?
I do. And I mean, I think I find myself supporting young folks, but they also turn to their peers, I think, more than coming to, you know, people in official leadership positions. Mm. But it's great to be available to them if there's something maybe in their school, if there's a teacher who isn't respecting their pronouns, or if they don't know what the school policy is around accessibility to an all-gender bathroom. So to have folks available to help young people navigate those situations, but then also I think a lot of our local towns are taking steps to do things like limit the LGBTQ pride flag being flown on town property. Mm-hmm. And so we've been working with local pride leaders, libraries who host drag story hours, and others where there's a more organized protest around limiting the rights of and visibility of queer people in Connecticut. So it's good to, it's powerful to be here for the youth, but also for others who are facing more coordinated and organized attacks.
Folks, if you're joining us, we're talking with Rachel Simon, Executive Director, and Julie Walsh, Deputy Director of Triangle Community Center in Norwalk. They offer over 25 regular programs to the LGBTQ community. We've heard about a few so far. We'll talk about more of them. I just want to give both of our guests a moment while we remind you that a singer-songwriter that I had an opportunity to work with a little bit who is a Connecticut resident, is going to be coming in. I remember talking to her when she was just starting to formulate the idea of possibly putting together a theatrical production. And here it is, 2024, and Birds of New York is coming to the Westport Country Playhouse with Grammy Award nominee and Westport resident Sophie B. Hawkins. It's coming up Tuesday night, June 25th at 7 p.m., part of the Barnstormer series in the Lucille Lortel White Barn Center next to the Playhouse in Westport. Hawkins is going to offer an intimate evening alongside an accomplished cast of Broadway performers while she shares a sneak peek into Birds of New York, where she plays Billy, a songwriter who returns home after 20 years of estrangement to heal herself and unite her family. Tickets are just $20, general admission, non-reserved seating. If you'd like full details, go check out westportplayhouse.org. For information on that show and all the programs that they're offering. Once again, we are pleased to be with Rachel Simon and Julie Walsh from the Triangle Community Center, an organization that's had a long history with us here on For the People and is doing great work. So here we are in the waning weeks of Pride Month. Rachel, as this program is playing on June 23rd, are there any more Pride Month activities that are going to be happening in or with the center?
So there are, there's a Pride calendar put out by the Leonard Litz Foundation and Circle Care Center that has put together all of the town prides that are going on. And I can't remember offhand who is at the end of the month, but if you check the Triangle Community Center social media at CT Pride Center, we will have a link so folks can find out who's up at the end of the month.
Very good. ctpridecenter.org is also their website, by the way. So we talked about a few of the programs in the last few minutes that we have. Julie, what was one of these many programs that struck you as being really, really awesome in the past few months that you've been with the center?
I am just so thrilled to see all of the affinity groups that happen here at the center. There really is a place for everyone, whether someone wants to hang out and do therapeutic arts for teens and adults, the groups for our Q teens or queer teens, groups for our parents through PFLAG, and groups here for folks in recovery. If someone is looking for a way to connect with community, I am really impressed with what is being done with that type of programming here. And I encourage any of your listeners to come out and find a group that really resonates with them.
Very good. Rachel, if you would please just detail quickly the clinical services that Triangle Community Center provides, because I think this is really the place that Triangle has been a leader in the LGBTQ community for many, many years.
Yeah, so we offer free case management and free therapy to pretty much anyone in need. We have MSW social workers, we have LMFT, licensed marriage and family therapists, and then graduate student interns in those areas where we really try to support folks and meet them where they are. We have a young adult housing navigator that works with folks who are 18 to 25, because we found that if someone can avoid being houseless at that age, it has a long-term impact on them. And so if you go to the website, ctpridecenter.org, you can see the intake forms and all of the options for what folks can find here. And I will say that during the pandemic, we got very good at seeing people remotely. So even if you're not immediately in the Norwalk, Stamford area, if you are somewhere else in the state, we are available to support you and families.
Excellent. I can't wait to talk again and hear more about the center and upcoming programs as both of you get more comfortable in your roles. Rachel Simon, the executive director of the Triangle Community Center since last September, and Julie Walsh, a much more recent transplant here in Connecticut from Indiana. We thank you both for being part of this program and this series. ctpridecenter.org is where you start online, or check out their social sites. They've got programs, events, training, clinical services, as you heard, and you can check their calendar for not only any remaining Pride Month activities going on in the region, but also for all of the great social activities and groups and supports that are available through Triangle. ctpridecenter.org. Julie and Rachel, great to meet you, and thank you so much. Perhaps our next visit can be in person down there, and we can do kind of a live radio walkthrough and really get people involved in some of the great things you guys got going down there. So appreciate your time this morning. Well, a lot of exciting things happening here in Connecticut, and a lot of the arts and culture that are being brought to you are either being supported by or are in some way influenced by CT Humanities. Founded in 1974, Connecticut Humanities is an independent nonprofit affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. They connect people to the humanities through grants, partnerships, collaborative programs. They do projects, administration, and program development, and are supported by state and federal matching funds, community foundations, and gifts from private sources. Certainly, our guest this morning, Dr. Jason Mancini, Mancini is as excited as we are that the International Festival of Arts and Ideas is happening. He may be more so because he is going to be participating in it. We're going to be talking about an event that is going to be featuring our guest, the executive director for the Connecticut Humanities, Dr. Jason Mancini, in just a moment. We just want to tell you that children's mental health has been declared a national crisis by many, including the U.S. Surgeon General, and it remains a growing concern among parents. A new survey of about 500 parents through the Kids Mental Health Foundation found that 7 out of 10 parents and caregivers with children under 18 are concerned about their kids' mental health and wellness. But there's hope and a variety of resources, more than 500, in fact, including guides, videos, curriculum, and articles that have been created to build skills, literacy, and prevention habits on numerous topics. You're invited and encouraged to access any of these resources. All you need to do is visit kidsmentalhealthfoundation.org. All right, so here we are with Dr. Jason Mancini. He's Executive Director of Connecticut Humanities. And let's start by expanding on that introduction, Dr. Mancini, and your role when you came to Connecticut Humanities. Let's talk about your beginnings with this organization.
It's good to be here, John. Thanks. I've been with Connecticut Humanities now for about 6.5 years. It came from a long history working with tribal communities and specifically about 25 years on the Mashantucket Pequot Reservation at the Pequot Museum. And so I brought a lot of my community work with the tribes and with communities of color to Connecticut Humanities and thinking about the way we engage humanities work, education, civics engagement, and so on. And so with the team I have now, we've really set out to be a leader, shaper, and convener of culture in Connecticut. We've become more accessible and inclusive in our work through our funding, through our digital programs, our advocacy, professional development, and other partnerships. And we do this because we believe that humanities are invaluable to every citizen in this country and every person in this world, and certainly for Connecticut, we focus on cultivating engaged and informed citizens. It's central to our work.
Yeah, and certainly we see at cultural events, art installations, craft shows, even things like cooking demonstrations and concerts. We see people from all walks and all stripes who can come together and irrelevant of the medium, they can all stand side by side and experience the same inspiration or fulfillment and enjoyment. And so being part of an organization that's working so hard to not only build that range of opportunities for people, but to do it with a focus on inclusion, diversity, equity, and access must be really, really fulfilling given where you came from in terms of your background.
It is. It's central to who I am and the organization that I lead. And we've been doing some transformative work over the last 3 or so years during the pandemic. We had worked very closely with the State Office of the Arts and with the legislature in securing about $31 million to create the Connecticut Cultural Fund. And through that, we created a grant program that was awarding funds to over 700 cultural organizations across the state. And it was really central to re-engaging our public through the different kinds of organizations we have, opening up people's eyes to the breadth of culture we have in Connecticut. We have an incredibly rich cultural landscape, and I think this was an opportunity to really build on that. We, for the first time, were able to get grants to organizations led by and facing communities of color. So that had not been a major part of our work in the past. And now relationships and community-based engagement is really where we're at. I'm proud of it.
When you think about the arts and humanities, you really think about the experience that individuals have as they are witnessing it or participating in it. But your organization is committed to confronting bias, racism, and inequality. And there's probably no better way to do that than through an engaging and kind of user-friendly medium of some sort of arts or humanities activity.
Yeah, I think, you know, in the work that we do and in the collaborations and partnerships and grantees that we have, you know, we've been pretty clear about our goals around diversity, equity, and access. And I think, you know, part of that really also builds towards civic health and civic vitality. And I think in our current era of polarization, I think humanities is so central to bringing people together and focusing on what we share in common, not what divides us. So this is the work that we're able to do across our organizations and across our communities. Our partners have been central to this. You know, as you talked about earlier, sort of mental health crises and educational deficits, you know, humanities is here for that. We are the types of organizations that bring people together and focus on how to improve how our society works by really looking at ourselves, looking at the people around us and the world around us, and how to better engage it.
Yeah. Are these events and activities and the people who give birth to these creative endeavors are really the ones that are blowing the holes through the walls that are separating us in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And you know, with programs like Arts and Ideas in New Haven and the work that they do in bringing people together from across the state around a variety of topics, it's the pinnacle of what we look for in the kinds of work that we do.
Yes. So we will have quite a historic VIP on the panel with you at the Arts and Ideas Festival coming up on Saturday, June 29th at 4 p.m. at the Humanities Quadrangle at the festival, absolutely free. You can meet and learn about the chair of the National Endowment for the Humanities, Shelley Lowe, a Navajo Native American by culture. And Jason is going to be also a part of that, discussing the critical role that the humanities play in tackling society's toughest contemporary challenges. Jason, how do you kind of prepare to squeeze as much good conversation and productive information out of an hour or so with someone like Shelley Lowe when you could probably go for days?
Indeed. And I have gone for days with Shelley. She and I have known each other for a number of years through our shared work with Native communities in this region. And we're thrilled to be hosting her here in Connecticut. And just for a little bit of background, we'll have her here for a couple of days and showing her around Connecticut, where she has been before. She spent some time at Yale in the past. So we will be in the eastern part of the state, in Mystic and Stonington, looking at some of the new exhibits at Mystic Seaport, talking with the tribal community about an initiative around a tribal college and work in the eastern part of the state. And then we'll be spending some time in New Haven thinking about the work that Yale's done with confronting their history with slavery and so on. And so, you know, the work that, or the conversation that I really want to shape with Shelley is thinking about the work that she's seen around the country that is addressing the most critical issues of our time. How are humanities organizations leading the way? And then I'm going to ask a little bit about what she sees in Connecticut that's inspiring. We've got some amazing organizations doing incredible work, and it very much fits in line with the broader NEH work and their American Tapestry initiative that seeks to connect our past with our present, with our future. You know, and I think one of the most invaluable things that we can learn from Chair Lowe is the ways in which is the first Native person to helm the National Endowment for the Humanities, how her perspective as a Native person has informed or reshaped the work of the agency. And I think this is something we haven't had before, and it's a new day.
Now, if you could help listeners understand a little bit of the dynamics between the National Endowment for the Humanities and your organization, Connecticut Humanities, how much connectivity is there, and how does one kind of support and feed the other?
Yeah, so the National Endowment was created in the 60s, and by the early 70s, many state and territorial councils were coming online. And so we are one of 56 state and territorial affiliates of the National Endowment. And so our relationship is both as a partner. So we accomplish much of the grassroots work that the National Endowment for the Humanities seeks to accomplish on a statewide level for Connecticut. We get into every community. Our work affects all Connecticut residents in one way or another. And so the deployment of the state and territorial or jurisdictional councils is critical to the mission of the National Endowment. We also advocate in Washington for funding for the National Endowment. They can't advocate for themselves, so we on the grassroots level advocate our legislators to continue this investment. You know, it's the founding legislation of NEH specifically mentions that democracy demands wisdom in its citizens. And democracy is rooted in the humanities, and the wisdom is rooted in the humanities.
Well, in regards to your organization and earlier conversation, it sounded like during the COVID era, there was a lot of positive development and fortifying and some, affirming of positions as well as growth in Connecticut Humanities. But at the same time, the COVID era took its toll on the humanities and arts communities, and particularly all of the small venues that tend to host a lot of these activities, the galleries, the theaters and such, the dance studios and concert halls. Although, if anything, the International Festival of Arts and Ideas proves that, you don't need a box to put a great, creative, entertaining art in. These venues certainly have their place, and it's really pleasing to see headlines in recent weeks that the federal government is also turning its attention to supporting the spaces in which the arts and humanities are presented.
Yeah, it's absolutely critical to the foundation of our country and our democracy. And the knowledge systems that exist, the intellectual drive and creativity and entrepreneurialism is rooted in this work. And we know when the state, when the federal government invests in arts and humanities, communities thrive and our nation will thrive. I think, you know, one of the things that we've lost sight of clearly in recent years is the civic vitality of our communities and the ways in which our organizations, our cultural organizations can bring us together. Mm-hmm. It's critical.
And when we speak of pride, national pride, certainly, you know, one of the biggest things that we'll be focusing on as a nation is America 250, the 250th anniversary. And your organization is joining with many others across the country and playing a role in that celebration. Let's steer toward the end of our conversation by looking forward to that and how Connecticut Humanities is going to be part of it.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, John. So I'm the state's the vice chair of the state's 250th commission, and Connecticut Humanities is administering the work of the commission. And this is we've developed a number of themes that we're focused on. One is telling inclusive stories. We'll also address the power of place. And how our localities are so significant to our histories and community groundedness, doing history so that people are understanding where they come from, where our nation has come from, so that we understand where we're going. And then for the common good. And this really speaks to the civic dimension of our work. So we know our nation is founded on individuality and independence, but I think we also need to bring back a sense of our common goals, our common future for the good of our nation. And so we will be we have quarterly meetings. We'll be having a public meeting on July 17th, so people can listen to that. More information about all of this is online at ct250.org. We hope that your listeners, elected leaders, will help us to establish relationships with their communities and the planning that they may be thinking about and being in contact with us so that we can help them to commemorate this moment. We are looking to reach as many Connecticut residents as possible. So we're not just looking into our history, but into our future. We want to make sure that Black and Brown communities, Indigenous communities, LGBTQ folks all see themselves in this commemoration. If it wasn't in our past, it's in our future. And I think that's what we're excited about.
Since 2018, our guest this morning, Dr. Jason Mancini, has been leading Connecticut Humanities, focusing on strengthening organizational partnerships, engaging diverse audiences, and anchoring Connecticut's placemaking, public history, and integrative digital initiatives. You can see him in a conversation with his friend, Shelley Lowe, the chair of the National Endowment for Humanities, in a free talk as part of the International Festival of Arts and Ideas, part of the Ideas Summit in the Humanities Quadrangle. Once again, absolutely free, this great chat happening on Saturday, June 29th at 4 p.m. Dr. Mancini, best of luck with this and the efforts that you're doing in helping leading Connecticut to be a big part of America 250. And best of luck in your event coming up on the 29th. We appreciate your time this morning. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA for our program that's relevant to the audiences and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to john.vocat@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program can be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast.
Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station websites. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Bayet. I'm Director of Public Affairs John Voquette. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime. Just find it under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.